Chapter 5 of Duncan's War. So here I go. "Duncan," called Jamie, grinning as he made his way around the corner of the barn. "You're not with the sheep?" "Aye," replied Duncan, stealing a glance at his friend's leg. He could still see the scar, the leg bone that had a bend and twist in it that made it seem as though the leg was trying to walk in a different direction from the rest of Jamie. A wave of guilt swelled in Duncan as he thought of his own legs and how fast he ran with them, and could still run. On the other hand, though his friend's leg was crooked, Jamie possessed an uncommon strength. He could carry heavier loads, far greater distances than any other lad Duncan knew. Sure, Duncan had to slow his pace when walking somewhere with his friend, but at the end of the day, it was always Jamie who plodded on unwearied. Duncan sometimes wondered how long he could do it. It seemed to be a matter of honor for Jamie, and his uncommon strength had grown steadily into a strength of another and a deeper kind. "Aye," repeated Duncan, "father needs the use of your traps. Needs the use of your traps for rats. My mother sent these along." She held out a bundle of food. I am sure we're grateful for her," said Jamie. When he returned from delivering food to his mother in the kitchen, he said, "Word is George Henry got his days flipped around again." "You mean he's conducting services today on Saturday?" "On the Saturday?" asked Duncan, his eyes flashing with interest. "Aye, so says Nigel, who heard it from the window ferryman," said Jamie. And Mrs. Nothing, the ferryman's widow, living as she does on the river just at the foot of the hill, hard by the kirk, would ken the best. Just then, a little valley of Glenkin rang with a bell from the kirk. Duncan stifled a laugh. He saw his mind the red-faced little man puffing as he yanked on the bell pulls, unaware his drunken stupor that it wasn't even Sunday. Duncan slapped his palm against his forehead. He had an idea. "Jamie, do you suppose," he began. "Duncan," said Jamie wearily, "what is your cooking up in that head of yours? What do ye say that we make our own way down to the kirk?" His eyes shone with excitement. "And hide out? We could watch what he does." "Och, Duncan, what would ye want to be doing that for?" "I'm not talking about participating in the service, Jamie," said Duncan, shaking his head. So we'd not be breaking the covenant," he went on, "only seeing what he does." Jamie frowned. Though he would never have gone alone, he too was curious about what went on the parish kirk, now that the Bishop of Glasgow had appointed the little drunk clerk. If we don't go along now, we'll be too late to hide out before he begins," urged Duncan. Within minutes, puffing hard from running, Duncan and Jamie rounded the corner of the kirk, its stepping gables rising above the graveyard. Duncan pointed to the ground, and Broody crouched low and lay on his haunches, out of the view behind the great sandstone slab and gate of a grave marker. Smiling with satisfaction, Duncan knew that regardless of how much time it elapsed before his return, regardless of what the weather might do, or any other provocation sort of someone killing his dog, Rudy would never move until Duncan or his father gave the command. "Hurry or we'll be late," hissed Jamie. "Late?" replied Duncan. "We're sure to be the only ones. No one comes services on Saturday. That's where you're wrong, Duncan. George Henry will take roll, and then he'll turn over the list of those who failed to come up to the services of those of James Turner's commanders. Be sure of it, Saturday or Sunday, they'll load fines on everyone who isn't here. Fines or worse. In a crouching run, they made their way to the narrow Gothic arch of the entrance. They heard the clerk stumbling around in a tiny vestry, but other than that, the church appeared empty. Looking carefully both ways, they scurried across the flagstone floor of the Gordon aisle. The south transept would provide good cover among the rigid stone effigies where the Gordons of Earlstone, partons from the parish, lay at the west. William Gordon, the present patron, had been cruelly banished from all Scotland forever for refusing to agree George Henry's appointment to the kirk. Duncan's father used to sell sheep to the Gordons, and Duncan sometimes envied the great fortified house, the small castle the Gordons used to live in just northeast of the village. Duncan frowned. Its stout walls and battlements had not protected even the Gordons from the cruel clutches of tyranny. Jamie set up a position near the chain-mailed feet of some of the ancient lords of Earlstone, while Duncan peered out from over the stone face gap between the prominent nose and jutting a chin, providing the perfect position for Duncan's curious eye. Within moments, crofters, still wearing their working clothes, their heads known as eyes, not looking at one another, began drifting into the tiny nave of the church. Duncan suppressed an urge to stand up and shout at them for breaking the covenant and stopping to attend the service, where Laud's liturgy and all the popish trappings held sway. He hissed as much to Jamie. And a fine sight ye'd make, Duncan MacKeith, being here yourself. And his ever insightful friend. Duncan looked up at the solid ribbed vaulting of the nave, and he thought of all those Sabbaths out on the moors of the braes and the rain beating upon down them, maybe snow, driven by the cruel winds, stinging on their faces, a very young elderly growing sick from exposure to bitter elements, a roof like over their head that over their heads he decided would be a fine thing indeed. The ringing of the small high-pitched bell called him back to attention. The sparse congregation scuffled to their feet. For an instant, nothing happened. Then, straining to see over the Gordon's nose, Duncan watched to the strangest sight. George Henry, a man with perpetual ill house, stooped to his shoulders, robed in red and white, staggered down the aisle. Now Dalry was a small village, and an ill afford to support one drunken clerk, let alone the procession of them. But George Henry liked the pomp of the high church procession, so from his first day he insisted on the formal procession, though he was the only one in it. In his left arm, the short, stooped clerk juggled a large brass cross on the tall staff of the tattered Bible, held it upside down. Several times he dropped the Bible with a slap bang into the flagstone floor. But strangest of all, From his right hand dangled a chain, holding a censer filled with burning incense. With a heave, he began swinging the chain back and forth. Duncan sniffed the air and screwed up his face in disgust. Each pendulum in the censer seemed to plunge the little man precariously forward, sending him groping for balance with each swing. Stifling an almost uncountable urge to laugh, Duncan pressed his face hard against the stone shoulder of the Gorgon Agafy. He could hardly tell whether the censer was swinging the censer. A low haze of blue smoke hung over the little assembly. Duncan blinked his eyes and gripped his nose. He sensed that now they were done for. Finally, arriving at the altar, a zigzag wake of blue smoke lingering in the aisle side behind him, George Henry turned toward those who had indeed the tolling of the bell. Those who had heeded the tolling of the bell. The Kirk's lip curled into a disdainfully at the sparse congregation, and he gave his call to worship. "God or I be hanged over this pulpit." He paused, steadying himself against the altar screen as he glared. "But I shall force ye all to come in, from the highest to the lowest." The service thus begun, it was small wonder that Duncan and Jamie got little out of what followed. Duncan frequent uncomfortable pauses. George Henry mumbled to himself, noisily shuffling pages as he hunted for his place in the prayer book. When he failed to find it, he used an opportunity to rail against traitors who rebelled against the powers that be ordained of God. Then he did finally find his place. He seemed blissfully unaware as he slurred his way through a prayer of confession that he turned more than one page and was nonsensically concluding the prayer by reading a collect for coronation of a monarch. It didn't seem to matter the congregation either. Duncan and Jamie stared in amazement at what happened next. Dark smoke began billowing out of the censer. George Henry paused, screwed up his face, sniffed the air, then narrowed his eyes suspiciously at the congregation. Suddenly, flames leapt up his robes. The bumbling clerk had forgotten to set the censer down from where it hung at his side. It smoldered against his gown. Now in flames, the little crew screeched in panic. Then, failing at the flames, looking at the folds of his gilded vestments, and amidst a barrage of curses, George Henry spun and whirled across the chancel and around the altar. For a fleeting moment he watched, Duncan even wondered if the fire and the dancing might all have been part of a plan to get more people to come to church. With a final roar of blasphemies, a farce of a service ended when George Henry stumbled to the floor and began rolling frantically around the chancel, finally extinguishing the flames. The new shame-faced villagers who had attended left without a word. Once clear of the Kirk, Duncan collected the dutiful broody, and he and Jamie collapsed on the banks of the River Ken at the foot of the churchyard. They laughed until their sides ached and the tears streamed down their cheeks. "I've never seen anything more ridiculous," gasped Duncan when he could finally speak. "Now I can why they why they don't compete. Aye, agreed Jamie, though his face grew somber. Aye, but it's all so tragic. Now that's the cause of ye for laughing so, came a voice from the river's edge. Greetings to ye, little ferryman, called Duncan and Jamie to the ferryman. The widow ferryman's cottage lay at the foot of the churchyard at the bend where the river narrowed. From her doorstep, a chain ran across the river. On that chain, since her husband died years ago, the ferryman's widow pulled strong hand, carrying local farmers, villagers, and now then a cow or horse back and forth across the river in her flat-bottom barge. For her keen ability to see all and know all, the widow ferryman was known throughout the entire Glenkin region as Mrs. Nothing. "Go on, then," she said, grinning expectantly. "Let me in on the joke, lads." The boys looked at each other before replying. "You weren't at the service today?" asked Duncan. "Nay, I had none of this kind of services," replied the old woman, nodding her head up the hill toward the church. "But don't they find ye?" asked Jamie. "Aye, but why don't they put ye in prison?" asked Duncan. "And leave your kind to swim in the river," she said, narrowing her eyes sagaciously. "So they leave ye be then?" asked Jamie. "For as long as the river keeps flowing, they do," she replied. "And now and again I picks up a bit of useful information. Useful, that is, for your our covenanting side." "Like what?" "Like then Turner, black-hearted swine, and his dragoons are fixing to drag their nets through the glen," she replied. "You heard anything of that lately, then?" asked Jamie. "Aye," she said, looking sober. "What then?" asked Jamie. "The fact is, dragoons are dull this very afternoon," she said. "I'll be forced to ferry them across. They don't pay except in leaving me alone. They'll call at the men's, and then George Henry hands off the list of those who failed to compete at the kirk today. Mind ye, it's not being the Sabbath makes no never mind to them. Repeat offenders near the hand will pay." As the stout woman pulled away the chain and crossed the river, Jamie's face clouded. "What's wrong with ye?" asked Duncan. "My family is so near to hand," said Duncan, spinning on his heel and with his steady lumbering gait, making toward home. "And my family's repeat offenders." And hard as Duncan ran, Jamie seemed never far behind as they raced to the Kilbride farm with the news. "Duncan McKeith," said John Kilbride, looking up from the drenching in an eel. "You're back again. And by the look of ye, something's troubling ye." "What is it then, lad?" Duncan opened his mouth to blurt the news when Jamie called from just behind. "The word is, father," he said, "Turner's men are on the rampage again." "Now, from whom did you hear it?" asked Jamie's father levelly. "Mrs. Nothing just told us," said Duncan. "And she..." I can, said Jamie's father. "She misses nothing." "All right, then. We are in the Lord's hands, but we best be prudent and disappear. I ken the fines have mounted against me for failing to compete at the kirk. And now Turner's men are rampaging up from the Dunfires to collect them. It had to come, and it has, But while in spring plantings pressing all about us, he turned around and looked at Duncan. "Now then, Duncan, if you're caught here with us, you're done for, lad. You'd best scatter to your brae, and quickly." John Kilbride turned and began preparing his family for the flight. Duncan shifted his weight from one bare foot to the other. He couldn't leave them. Jamie had disappeared inside to help his mother and sisters pack. Jamie reappeared with a heavy burlap sack on his shoulder. Duncan knew that somewhere in that sack there would be books. And if he could have nothing else, it'd be books Jamie would save. In their characteristically unhurried manner, Jamie and his father steadily hefted a small mound of belongings into a farm cart. Shaking his stocky head, the farm horse stomped its hairy fetlocks and champed at its harness. Jamie helped his mother hoist all his three sisters into the cart, where they clambered on top of the hasty packed bundles. "Where are you going to hide?" asked Duncan. "I don't know," the farmer said, running his hand through his hair. "But they're sure to take us if we stay here. They'll fire the house. They'll seal my flock." His voice trailed into a moan. Then he said, a firmness returning to his voice, "But God is on our side, and though he fights our battles for us, I'll not just give in to him." Duncan looked down at Rudy. An idea suddenly occurred to him. "John Kilbride, Rudy, and I'll run your mob up to the glen, our place, or the ancient Criers," he said, the excitement mounting as he spoke. "If ye can disappear for now, we can tend your sheep for ye, and ye can join us up at the brae when ye can. You'll be safe enough there for now." It didn't sound as a great idea when he finished. He wanted to tell them about the old passage in the castle. "The Lord Cairns will not put ye in danger, Duncan," said John Kilbride. "But my father would want me to help," asked Duncan pleadingly. "I can," he would. "Turner'd see you're helping us as a sedition," said John Kilbride, arguing more with himself than with Duncan. "How would I face your father if Turner arrested you for lending aid to me and my family?" "I'll not get caught," said Duncan. "Jamie knows how fast I run." Duncan stopped short. "My father," chimed in Jamie. "Duncan runs like the wind." "Nothing else for it," said Duncan Kilbride, his shoulders drooping resignedly. "We'll take the lambs while we can in the cart." He took Duncan by the shoulders again, and Brasfer Road stared in his eyes. "You scatter to the mist at anything, lad. I'll not be living with myself if you're lost for helping us." So that was chapter 5. Bye, guys. See you later. See you later. See you later. See ya. See ya later. Bye, guys.